For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, welcome to the role of apologetics in evangelism. I'm going to be your instructor for the next hour. My name is James Rochford. I teach at the North Central Teaching, the high school ministry. I teach CTs for high school, college, adult, teach classes here at Xenos. And I'm teaching a class in apologetics right now. All right. We're doing a 10-week class here at our fellowship on apologetics. What we're doing today is just to look at the practical outworking, the integration between evangelism and apologetics. So if you came here looking for an espousal of the different arguments for God or defense of Christianity, you're in the wrong class, because I have neither the time nor the inclination to do that. But you can always take my class this summer if you're looking for that. We meet on Wednesday. So anyhow, we're going to be looking at three different questions here this afternoon. Number one, what are apologetics? Number two, why should we use apologetics? And then number three, how ought we use apologetics in regards to evangelism? So what are apologetics? Why should we use them? And how do we use them? Well, let's get started with that first question. What are apologetics? What are apologetics? I remember the first time I came in contact with the subject of apologetics, I was a new believer. I had just read Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, a terrific book. And after I finished the book, I flipped it over. I was looking at C.S. Lewis's bald head on the back of that book. And in the bottom corner, it said category, Christian apologetics. I thought, apologetics? What is it that we're apologizing for? I read this book cover to cover, didn't hear anything about apologizing. Well, the subject of apologetics comes from a Greek word that was used in ancient history. In fact, this term was used by ancient attorneys to refer to their legal defense in a court of law. The Greek term was apologia. Apologia. This was the term that ancient attorneys used in ancient times to talk about their legal defense, their presentation of their case in court. For instance, Paul in Acts chapter 22, verse 1, uses this term in that sense. While he's on trial in front of his interlocutors in chapter 22, Paul said, "Brothers and fathers, listen now to my apologia, listen to my defense." So this was a term that they used to describe their defense in a court of law. So when it came time for the New Testament authors to pick a word to discuss the way in which a Christian should defend their faith, they landed on the term apologia, which was a legal term. Well, let's open this up for discussion. What are some of the qualities you would want in an attorney if you were paying them $100 an hour in the court of law? Let's get a few ideas here. Okay, very good. So if you had an attorney, if you're paying them good money, if your butt was on the line, you'd want them to be knowledgeable in order to defend you. Yes? Okay, so perhaps some experience where they're able to interact with some of the arguments, perhaps even the attorney that's going to be prosecuting you. Okay?
Want them to be calm, not get easily frustrated or angry.
Okay, so you wouldn't want your attorney just to blow up and start swearing in the middle of the courtroom, get the court case thrown out, bad idea? Yeah.
Persuasive.
Okay, so an attorney needs to be persuasive. That's good. Yeah? Okay, so experience would probably help. Okay? Yeah, right here.
I would want them to believe me. You know what I'm saying? I really trust what I was saying.
Okay. So this is where the illustration might break down. If we were in a court of law, we might actually just want the attorney to defend us no matter what, but a truly good attorney would want to bring about justice and to do right. Okay?
Like
like firm in their beliefs or what they're saying. You don't want them to say something that, that like retract their statement.
Okay, so they have to be kind of confident in what they're saying is true. Back that up. That's good. Nobody said deceitful, huh? Okay, well, I guess all those attorney jokes are out. Well, when it came time for the New Testament authors to pick a word, like I said, they picked this term apologia. We see this in 1 Peter 3:15, where Peter says, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. So whatever is going to come after what he's saying here must be referring in some kind to our sanctification, setting Christ apart in our hearts. Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. So we see right here this term defense, I'm sure you could guess, is none other than the Greek term apologia. Okay. Always being ready to make an apologia. So think of the imagery that would conjure up in a first century Christian. I have to make a legal defense of the Christian hope that I have. Well, in many ways, this verse is very unfair. Always being ready. So it's not enough that when you're in a conversation with someone that you can do this verse. You can't. You cannot do this verse once you're already in the conversation. To be prepared, as the Boy Scouts say, implies that you are being prepared in advance. So this would mean study, preparation, thoughtful prayer, discussion, debate, until finally you're at the point where you're actually prepared to make a defense. To whom? Well, to everyone. Every single worldview. The Christian worldview has to be ready to give a defense to every other worldview out there, every single person. For the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. So we don't want to be argumentative when we witness for Christ. We do want to argue without being argumentative. Some people call this winning the argument but losing the person. You ever heard that expression? The Bible's against that. The Bible is not for losing the argument and winning the person. The Bible's for winning the argument and winning the person. It's for both. So we don't want to take the super spiritual aspect where we're going to lose arguments. We don't want to do that. That would be going against this verse. However, we should argue in such a way that's representative of Christ, that is kind, reverent, gentle, is the way he puts it. In other words, we don't want to go for the slam dunk. We don't want to go for the pin when we're talking to someone. We need to be gentle, respectful of that individual. Well, Philippians 1:7 says, both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, you are all partakers of grace with me. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. So here we have the Apostle Paul actually claiming that his ministry is for the apologia, the defense of the gospel. That's his central mission. Titus 1:9, referring to overseers or elders in the church, it says that the overseer must hold fast the faithful word, which is in accordance with the teaching, so that he will be able both to exhort in sound doctrine. So you have to be able to teach what's true, period. No. And to refute those who contradict. So it's not enough to get up and to give your public teaching to an assembly of Christians. You have to be able to explain your view. Then you have to be able to refute those who contradict the truth. If you're familiar with apologetics, you are certainly familiar with this verse. Romans 1:20 says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen through what? Being understood through what has been made. And this is so evident that you could look out into creation and see something about the nature and attributes of God. It's so clear that Paul writes, so that all men on earth are without excuse. Now the Greek term here for without excuse is anapologetos. Now you don't need to be a Greek scholar to know what this word means. If you just break it down, the prefix in Greek, the alpha, is just the negation. So it begins with an alpha, then it gets into apologia, apologetas. Literally what Paul's saying is they don't have an apologetic. They don't have a legal defense, a rational defense for denying that God exists. 2 Corinthians 10:5, we're destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. We're taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. So both the negative implication, we're going after negative false beliefs, and we're also espousing positive true beliefs. 2 Corinthians 5:11, therefore, knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade men. And guess what context this was given in? Evangelism. Verse 19 and 20, Paul says, we plead with you on behalf of God, be reconciled to God. So we persuade men, given in the context of evangelism. Okay, so what we've seen so far are imperatives. In biblical language, these are commands. All Christians are commanded to defend their faith rationally. But then in addition to this, we also see examples of it throughout the book of Acts. Many people often ask, how is it that the early church could have reached so many different people, so many people in such a short amount of time? Kenneth Lauderette, a Christian historian, estimates that Christianity exploded from 500 people in AD 33 to 1 million people by the end of the first century. So that's 2,000-fold growth in just under 70 years. How is it that the early church was so powerful at reaching people for Christ? Well, we don't have to wonder. We can open up to the book of Acts and see a repeated theme. Acts 17, verse 2, and according to Paul's custom, he went to them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead. And some of them were persuaded. Some of them listened to him. Acts 18, 4, and he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath and trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. Acts 18, 28, for he powerfully refuted the Jews in public. Did you know that Paul held public debate and he was able to hold his ground publicly? Acts 19, 8, and he entered the synagogue and continued speaking out boldly for 3 months. So Paul just planted himself down, and for 3 months it was like he was saying, come and get me. They came after him, and it says that he was reasoning and persuading about the kingdom of God. Acts 26, 25, Paul told Festus that the Christian faith was, quote, true and reasonable. Okay, if you're sick of all those verses, if you're thinking, why did we have to read all those? What you have to realize is that when God is trying to communicate something, what he'll do is either give very strong, emotive language to say that this is important, or another aspect of it is that he'll give emphatic language. He'll keep emphasizing something over and over. So what ought we conclude about apologetics, about what they are? First off, the definition of apologetics. The rational defense and articulate communication of the Christian faith. That's what apologetics are. Number two, apologetics are a command to all believers, not just the leaders. They're commanded for them especially, Titus 1:9. But they're actually commanded to all Christians. 1 Peter 3:15 is given in this context. Thirdly, they are not only taught in the Bible, but they're emphasized. They're not only taught, they're emphasized. So we hold to the maxim that we not only want to teach what the Bible teaches, we want to emphasize what the Bible emphasizes. And this is a biblical emphasis. This is not something out on the periphery that doesn't matter. This is central to reaching people for Christ. Well, let's move on to that second question. That's what apologetics are. Number two, why should we use apologetics? Why should we use apologetics? Well, many Christians often say, why should we use apologetics when Jesus himself taught Mark 10:14 that in order to get into the kingdom of heaven, you had to have the faith of a child. You had to have a childlike faith. And so from this, many fideistic Christians, fideism just means a belief in faith, a rejection of evidence, just believing because you believe. Many fideistic Christians claim that Jesus didn't want some highly intellectual, rational, evidential kind of faith. Instead, what Jesus wanted was a childlike faith, a simple faith. And in fact, he said you can't get into heaven unless you have a childlike faith. Well, I think that that is a gross interpretation, gross misinterpretation of that passage. Number one, in Ephesians 4:14, Paul says that we ought not to go on as children. Now, critics will look at that and say, see, the Bible contradicts itself. Jesus said you should be like a child. Paul said you shouldn't. The Bible's incoherent, makes no sense. We should throw it out. Well, of course not. Instead, what we should learn is that Paul is saying we ought not to be like children in regards to doctrine and intellectual matters. But we should be like children in regards to humility and trust. Ephesians 4 is given in the context of false teaching that will toss believers to and fro. He said you ought not to be like children. You should be like adults, the mature man. Secondly, Mark 10 refers to the context of Mark 10 refers to the self-righteousness of the Pharisees and the pride of wealth. That's what Mark 10 is about. And sandwiched in between that, Mark 10:14 states, well, you should have like a faith of a little child. Jesus was not emphasizing the virtue of stupidity or ignorance. He was emphasizing the virtue of trust and dependence. That's what Mark 10 is about. Here's the way Francis Schaeffer describes it. This is from his book, Two Contents, Two Realities. Regarding Mark 10, he says, did you ever see a little child who didn't ask questions? People who use this argument must never have listened to a little child or been one. My four children gave me a harder time with their endless flow of questions than university people ever had. Yeah, have you ever been around kids? You ever been around that little snot-nosed, little annoying kid, and you say, hey, we got to get in the car. Why? Because we have to go to the store. Why? Because we have food at the store. Why? Well, because we can't all grow farms and gardens. We need to go to the store because they bring food there. Why? Well, because that's just the way it is. Kids are incessantly annoying in their questioning about the world. Why? 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 They're trying to figure things out. Well, we could also point out, Jesus Christ himself didn't advocate blind faith. Jesus appealed to his miracles, his resurrection, and predictive prophecy to authenticate his truth claims, Luke 24. Jesus appealed to the classic a fortiori argument form throughout the Gospels. A fortiori was kind of an older argument form that just means for a stronger reason. If I gave you $100 and you're happy, how much more happy would you be if I gave you $1,000? That was the argument. He used that throughout the four Gospels. Jesus would, quote, debate publicly. Mark 12:28. He'd hold public debates. His opponents would try to, quote, trap Jesus. But he argued so persuasively that they were, quote, amazed. Matthew 22:15 and Matthew 22:22. In one case, Jesus utterly, quote, silenced his opponents in debate. Matthew 22. In fact, if you just go home and read Matthew 22, you've got the Pharisees coming up, and Jesus is like, boom, and they go back away. The Sadducees come up, boom, and then the third party comes up, boom, boom, boom. Sends them down until finally the very last verse in Matthew 22, it says, no one was able to answer him a word, nor did anyone dare from that day on to ask him another question. So when it came time for Jesus to debate publicly, he could literally silence the opposition. Now, did Jesus do that in every interaction with unbelieving people? No. Jesus in his ministry asks roughly 150 questions of his opponents. He is gentle. He's reverent. He's patient with people. He doesn't slam people. He doesn't silence people. My view is that Jesus probably did this in Matthew 22 because it was at the end of his public ministry. And what he was doing was demonstrating that the unbelieving people in his generation, their problem with him was not intellectual. It was moral and spiritual. So he probably argued like a thrashing floor on that final week because he wanted to demonstrate, you know, your problem with me is not intellectual. It's spiritual. Now, Jesus wasn't answering the questions that modern people ask about. Jesus was not answering, does God exist? because he was ministering to a specific theocratic culture. They weren't questioning that. Jesus wasn't questioning or wasn't answering, is morality objective or relative? His culture believed that already, but he was answering their specific apologetic questions. Well, a second objection. Apologetics can be used abusively, pushing people further away from the gospel. We shouldn't use apologetics, because I've seen it happen where someone who's seeking for God, trying to learn and understand God, what will happen is somebody who gets into apologetics will come in and just beat them down and actually push people further away from Christ. Well, I have to admit, this is true. It's embarrassing to say. I'm embarrassed to say I've done it. You start learning these kind of things, you get more and more educated, you realize in a conversation, I know more about this other about this subject than the other person. Your head inflates, your ego inflates, and you can actually push people further away from Christ through abusively using apologetics. That is true. However, this must be why Peter says, always be ready to make a defense, yet with gentleness and reverence. It must have been that Peter foresaw the fact that apologetics could be used abusively, and he saw that coming. So we should use apologetics, but we should be gentle and reverent about it. In other words, we ought not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We should use apologetics in their correct way. What about objection number three? Apologetics don't lead people to Christ. The gospel leads people to Christ. Is that true? I guess that is true. You know, you ever heard the expression, you can't reason somebody to God. You can't argue someone into a corner. That is true. Well, I guess it's partially true. This is what they call a false dilemma. While it's true that our real obstacle with God is not intellectual, it's moral and spiritual. That's true. Jesus said that men agapeo the darkness, John 3:19. We sacrificially love the darkness, and we scurry out of the light. Jesus said it's kind of like cockroaches when you come into an old apartment building. You kick open the door and you turn the lights on, and the cockroaches scurry. That's us. That's humans. We don't want God. We don't want to be near God. None seek for God. We hate God. Okay, that's our fundamental problem. However, if we remove intellectual barriers, this can reveal our true issue, which is faith and trust. If we remove the intellectual barriers, this can show our real issue. This is the way theologian John Stott describes it. He says, we cannot pander to man's intellectual arrogance, but we must cater to his intellectual integrity. Really well said. We cannot pander to his arrogance, but we must cater to his intellectual integrity. You know, I'm sure you've heard the expression, you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Well, that's true, but you should still bring him to the water. Imagine if you had a lazy farmhand who argued this way. You know, Steve, why didn't you get up and bring the horses down to the water? Well, you know, Pa, if we take the horses to the water, I can take them there, but, you know, you can't make them drink. Okay, so we're going to let the horses die of dehydration, is what you're saying. Why don't you take them there, and then they can decide if they want to drink or not. That's their choice. Well, imagine if somebody argued this way. Social justice doesn't lead people to Christ. The gospel leads people to Christ. Is that true? Social justice, I guess that doesn't really lead people to Christ. It is the gospel that leads people to Christ. Does that mean we should stop doing social justice, for goodness sakes? Of course not. It's commanded. It's complementary, not contradictory, to our evangelistic mission. What if somebody said Christian friendship doesn't lead people to Christ? The gospel leads people to Christ. You can't socialize someone into becoming a Christian. You know that. So does that mean we should stop befriending non-Christian people? Your personal testimony doesn't lead people to Christ. The gospel leads people to Christ. Okay, loving Christian community doesn't lead people to Christ. Okay, you see the problem. These are false dilemmas, false dichotomies. That doesn't make any sense. You know, when I go out to speak to people, non-Christian people, I like to have as many arrows in my quiver as I possibly can. I'm a very bad evangelist. I'm not good at it. I try really hard. I mean, harder than most of you, but I'm not good at it. I'm sure 99% of the people in this room have had more success than I have in evangelism. But that means I have to work a lot harder. So I like to put as many arrows in the quiver as humanly possible. So I like to have a testimony prepared. I like to have a great Christian community. I like to have good works, good deeds in the community. All those things combined in order to reach people for Christ. Well, while apologetics do not force someone to believe in Christ as Savior, nothing we do forces someone to do that. Well, what then is the purpose of apologetics? What is the purpose of apologetics? I can think of a few reasons or a few things that are the purpose of Christian apologetics. Number one, apologetics rouse curiosity in the non-Christian. They rouse curiosity in the non-Christian. Whereas someone was completely apathetic to spiritual things. I'd like to just do a vote, okay? You have to vote. This is not the 2008 election. You have to vote, okay? How many people here have someone in their life who is just completely apathetic to spiritual things to the point where if you talk to them and you said, what do you think about spiritual things? They would say, I don't know and I don't care. Yeah. Our culture is largely apathetic to spiritual things. What apologetics can do is arouse curiosity. This is the way that C.S. Lewis describes it in his famous book, God in the Dock. He says, nearly everyone I know who has embraced Christianity in adult life has been influenced by what seemed to him to be at least probable arguments for theism. Now, that's kind of anecdotal. I don't know if he had a statistic, but everyone he had met who knew Christ in adult life, that was his experience. I can probably agree with that. Most of my friends who met Christ, there was something involved which led them up to that conclusion. Number two, apologetics give credibility to the Christian worldview. They give credibility to the Christian worldview. Whereas before, someone might say the Christian worldview is incredible, non-credible, apologetics can help build credibility. What Douglas Grutice, a Christian apologist, refers to as a plausibility structure. In our culture, unless you've been living underneath a rock in a dark cave somewhere with your fingers in your ears, our culture is not prone toward Christianity. They don't naturally think that it's true. There are some areas where people just kind of naturally are leaning in that direction. Most people are not. There's not a plausibility structure around Christianity in our culture. Here's one example. This is from the show South Park. I don't know if you watch the show. I do, but it's actually a lot more preachy than most sermons you hear, the show. But in this one particular instance, Mrs. Cartman turns to Eric and she says, Eric, there is no tooth fairy. To which Eric Cartman replies, I suppose you're going to tell me there's no Santa Claus, Easter Bunny, or Jesus either. Now let's look discerningly at that statement. What is he saying? What's the message? What's the subtext? There is no tooth fairy. Okay, since there is no tooth fairy, there's none of the others. Yeah, we, in other words, we made all this up. We invented this whole thing. Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and Jesus, those are all on the same criteria, the same platform. Did the air conditioning just come on? Praise the Lord. You think you're hot. I'm up here talking. So the plausibility structure, our culture doesn't even think it's plausible, even credible, that there could be a God and that Christianity is true. And I don't have to belabor that point. I'm sure you agree with that. Number three, apologetics remove barriers to belief. They remove barriers to belief. So this could be seen as certain people have talked to their friends, heard podcasts, radio, TV, internet articles, and there have been certain barriers that have been brought up, and Christian apologetics can pull that apart. Number four, apologetics build up the confidence of young or old Christian workers. Boy, this might be one of the best points for getting apologetics going in your home church or your fellowship. A number of years ago, our home church took in a group that had failed. They had fizzled. They had been out for a very long time, and the group just wasn't getting any traction. And somebody had the idea, instead of fighting some kind of war of attrition and keep going, we're just going to fizzle this group, and then they'll go into other different home churches. Well, our group took in a number of people from this particular group, one of whom had been walking with Christ for 4 years and had grown up in a Christian home before that. He came into our men's Bible study, and we were studying Romans 1, and we did a kind of a brief excursus into apologetics. And in the first week, he said, "I've never even heard the term apologetics. What does that mean?" Well, we started to explain it to him. We got him some resources. He started doing more reading. And within a year, he had done more witnessing than in his entire life put together. He went after the atheistic friends that he had. He went after a lot of the secular people in his life. So I don't know if those arguments really helped, but what they did was, when Christians start to learn apologetics, it beefs them up, gets their confidence up to go out and to speak to other people. Another purpose of apologetics, number 5, is that they're useful in educated fields of ministry, which most of us are in. You know, some people say, should we do apologetics in some very obscure tribal town in the middle of nowhere? Well, maybe they're not as important for that specific ministry context. Maybe they're not, but they are important in our field of ministry. We've noticed that in order to reach people who can lead groups, who can teach, who can reach large numbers of people, we need to be able to have some of the people coming into fellowship from educated backgrounds. Who's going to teach? Who's going to lead the church? We have to target these people along with everyone else. Well, some people would say, well, we shouldn't target them. Well, we should target everybody, but let's not leave them out by proxy. Okay, let's move on to number 3, which is the most important topic. Typically, when I teach class, people say, I wish it was more practical, more earthy. And then after this teaching last year, people were like, I wish you got into the arguments. I wish it was more abstract. So, sorry. You can email Sarah Parrott if you have a problem with that. Just kidding. How do we use apologetics? How do we use apologetics? Let's get real practical. The first thing we want to do is listen carefully. Most people think that when they learn apologetics, they should get out there and start preaching to people and using the arguments. Not a good idea. That's a good way for everyone to be scattering away from you at high speeds. First thing you want to do is listen carefully to the individual. There's the expression, to be listened to is to be loved. Many people have just no one listening to them at all. Mom, dad, friends. If Christians aren't the ones listening to them, then who will? Here's what Paul Little writes. Boy, this is a great book. How to Give Away Your Faith. The only reason I don't promote this book as much as I do is because it's on the cutting edge of 1965. It's old. He died in 75, Paul Little, but a great speaker. He came out of Trinity Evangelical. He has a little tiny book on the front cover. You've got guys with Beatles haircuts and shaking hands. It's really cheesy, but it's a good book. He says, the voice any person likes to hear best is their own. Everyone likes to talk, but some do more than others. Many people would give anything to find someone who would just listen to them. Boy, that is true. When we listen long enough, we not only begin to know and understand an individual, we also gain his gratitude and his willingness to listen to us. Let me repeat that. We not only listen to them, but we gain that person's gratitude. They're grateful, and they become willing to listen to us, enabling us later to speak relevantly to him. Have you ever been in a situation where someone is just talking, or let me put this a different way. You're in a situation where you're talking to your friend, talking, and after an hour goes by, you kind of feel a little bit bashful, you feel kind of stupid for talking the whole time, and then you say, what's going on with you? Yeah, after an hour or so. Well, when we're talking to non-Christian people, one of the things listening does is it gets them talking. We figure out what they believe, but we also gain their ear. They'll listen to us in return. Reciprocity. The Proverbs describe it. Proverbs 18:2, fools have no interest in understanding. They only want to air their own opinions. A fool just comes in, a kessel, just comes in, speaks a mile a minute, gives their opinion. Hey, shut up. Let the other person talk, you fool. Proverbs 18:13, spouting off before listening to the facts is both shameful and foolish. James 1:19, everyone knows this verse. Understand this, you must be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to get angry. One of the fruits of the Spirit is not only love, joy, peace, patience, but self-control, gentleness and self-control. One of the outworkings of God's work in our life is that we can be controlled, stop talking as much as we should be, close our mouths and listen. Jesus himself asked 150 questions in the gospel. Do you think Jesus didn't know the answer when he asked a question? He's the freaking Son of God. Of course he knew the answer. He knew exactly what the answer was. But he was asking it not for his benefit, but for theirs. One of the things we do when we listen is we discover their worldview. Discover their worldview. So not only do we get a hearing with them when it's our turn to talk, but we also discover their worldview, what they think. One of the biggest things we want to find out is this person a religious non-Christian or a secular non-Christian? A few years ago, there was a guy coming out to our home church who came from a particular traditional church, which I particularly do not like. And I thought that everyone also did not like that particular church. So he came out and he said, yeah, I come from this traditional church background. And I was like this close to being like, oh, you must think that church sucks, right? For some reason, it must have been the grace of God shut my trap. And instead, I said, so what did you think about that church? He said, oh, I love it. I love the tapestry. I love the incense. I love the tradition. I love the history. I love everything about it. So I thought, well, I'm glad I didn't assume. Make an ass out of you and me. Assume. Did you grow up going to church? What was that like? What did you think of it? Maybe somebody grew up going to church and they had a great time. They enjoyed it quite a bit. Maybe one of the people they look up to this day, they enjoy their friendship. Did you make any friends at that church? I think that's a pretty good question. Do you like people that went there, is the question. Would you consider yourself a religious person? No. Okay, would you consider yourself a spiritual person? Maybe, I think so, kind of. Well, would you consider yourself maybe a secular person? You don't really believe in any kind of religious faith? Well, maybe. So you want to find out what background they're coming from. Another idea here is you're trying to find out why they're rejecting God's RSVP. God's RSVP. There are four different ways that we can RSVP to God's invitation to a relationship with himself. And all four are important. Number one is R, rational. Number two is social. Number three is volitional. And number four is personal. So rational, you're talking to this individual. Do they reject Christianity because they think it's stupid? Because they think it's irrational. Some people, that's their main rejection. That's why they're not responding to God. What about social? I rejected Christianity because the church I grew up in was filled with hypocrites. The pastor was sleeping with the secretary. They were in sexual immorality. They were abusing children. And then they were getting on me for my cigarette smoking. I'm never going back to it. I'll never set foot in a church because of those hypocrites. Is it a social reason? It's not rational. Is it a volitional reason? Is there some kind of strong, powerful sin in their life that is causing them to reject Christ? There was a guy coming out to our home church about a year ago, and he asked every question under the sun. He sat in a series that we did where we laid out first cause of the universe, historicity of the New Testament. I laid out Daniel 9, prophecy. He sat through the whole thing and scoffed. He laughed at me, laughed at us. Talked to him for just about, I think he was around our group for about 3 months. 3 months into him coming around, and he was all these intellectual problems, we found out that he was involved in a particularly serious sexual sin, which I will not even name. Some things are not even appropriate to name in public, but he was into something really particularly gross and savage. And it kind of all came into focus at that point. You know, his issue was not intellectual problems, it was a moral problem, a volitional problem, issue of the will. Finally, number four, personal. Maybe this person has just never come in contact with God. Maybe they don't understand the idea that this is a personal relationship rather than a relationship with a cosmic blackboard or a cosmic machine. It's a relationship with a person. Have they ever called out to God? Have they ever prayed? Okay, another use of apologetics is dealing with the idea of common objections. One thing we should say here is that we should be prepared for common objections, but we should not be overwhelmed by them. We should be prepared, but not overwhelmed. Now, that's an important distinction. Let me put it in the words of Paul Little here. Little writes, now Little used to go to Harvard and these different Ivy League schools. He would sit down at these fraternity halls and he would talk to the frat guys about Christ and answer their questions. So he said it was really intimidating going to these first few Bible studies that I did. Well, he writes, leading my first few discussions was a major problem for me because I didn't know what to expect. He was walking in the door, he's flying blind. But now I can predict with a high degree of accuracy the questions that will be asked me in any given discussion with non-Christians. A few of the questions may depart from the pattern, but most of them will fit into one of several basic categories. I was getting my hair cut a little while back and started talking to the girl in there who was cutting my hair. It was just me and her in the shop, and we were talking for a while, and somehow Christianity came up in the discussion, and we were going back and forth, and she kind of looked, I don't know, kind of, she had really crazy looking hair, a snake tattoo coming out from under her neck, just looked really emo or something, I don't know what you call it, but we were sitting there talking, and somehow spiritual things came up, and she said, you know, do you go to church? I said, yeah. She said, which church? I said, Zenos Christian Fellowship. It's, you know, I explained, oh, I've heard of that church. And she said, well, what do you guys believe at that church? So I thought that was a trick question. So I said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, what do you believe that's controversial? So I said, wow, I'm really walking into a trap here. So I said, well, can you give me something specific? I don't really think anything we believe is controversial. She said, well, I can think of a few things. And before she said it, I could almost list the three things she was going to say. I said, well, what is it? She said, well, where do you guys stand on other religions? Where do you stand on gay sex? And where do you stand on tattoos? Now, the third one, the tattoo thing, I didn't see that coming, but probably should have. But I said, well, you know, I think Christianity is unique, and I think it's the only truth of God. And I think as far as homosexuals, I think they can be forgiven just like the rest of us because we're all sinful. But for as long as we're talking about tattoos, those people who have tattoos are going straight to hell. There's no hope for them. And they're going to burn in the lake of eternal fire. So she thought that was kind of funny. But, well, we're in that situation, I think, every day. When we talk to people, you almost know the 7 or 8 or 9 different objections they're going to ask. Let's hear them. Number one. Okay, moral issues. Let's just say moral issues. Okay, that's a good question. If God created, who created God?
Problem of evil.
Problem of evil, yeah.
Evolution.
Science and scripture, yeah.
Why so much suffering?
Okay, why so much suffering? Good.
History of the Bible.
Okay, New Testament, Old Testament questions.
Was it? Religion.
Okay, hypocrites in religion. Was anyone surprised by any of those topics that we just brought out? Of course not. They're the same 8, 9, 10 objections you're going to hear. So we should just focus on those specific objections, and if there's something else, we can study that later. Another thing under common objections that's important is to express your own personal doubts. Express your own personal doubts. I don't want this to be so formulaic that you think this is some kind of formula. Evangelism is not a science, it's an art, right? So I don't want to have some kind of formula that you're following. I don't like those evangelistic books, I think they're corny, but I hope by giving you some examples here, it'll help you put things in your own words. Here's the way I would say it, okay? if you're talking to someone and you're getting really heated, one way to kind of back off is to say, you know what, I really used to wonder about that too. It really bothered me quite a bit. Exactly what you're saying. Here's what helped me understand that difficult thing you're talking about. That makes it a little less contentious, where it's me and you arguing, versus why don't we walk together and search through this together? Maybe I could help you through that objection. Or, when I was wrestling through that, somebody shared this with me and it was very helpful. The problem of evil. Well, I, you know, you can kind of give your explanation. Learn long and short responses. This is important. I used to work at a valet. I said valet, not ballet. Every time I say valet, they think ballet. I don't have the figure to do ballet. Anyways, valet parking. And one of the things is we'd be in the booth, the valet booth. They'd have all the keys hanging up on the wall. And just when you were getting into a great talk with someone, it was really getting good and starting to move in the right direction. Bring! The guy would pick up the phone. Okay, we need car number 452 down from the lot. So you'd run, get the car, come back, be praying the whole time. God, I really pray that, you know, we can get back in this conversation. You get right back up there again. You'd start talking. Start to get really good. Bring! Hi, it's Satan in 305. I need my car, please. You don't have 10 minutes to explain something, do you? In fact, a lot of evangelistic books, if you read William Fay, it's a book I don't really like, but Sharing Jesus Without Fear, it's got some practical things in it, but William Fay's book, he says you really shouldn't even be witnessing on the job. That's his stance. What you should do is get them off the job, out after work, hang out with them, because you could be viewed as a bad worker if you're doing that on the job. Now, I think that's a little bit extreme, but you get the point. You know, you don't want to be seen as that Christian who's talking about God when you should be doing your work. So you need to know how to explain things in short little quips. If you're at work, you don't have 10 minutes to talk about this. You have a job to do. So you have to know how to say a 2-minute little catchy response that would be interesting to that person that when work's over, you can go and talk about it. So learn long and short responses. Okay, here's mine. Problem of evil. A young guy was coming out to our home church. He had a problem with the problem of evil. He had a bunch of friends of his that were into heroin who had overdosed. And he said, I just can't believe that a good God would allow that to happen to my friends. I watched them overdose. They died in my arms. How could God do that? So I said, well, what's your worldview? He said, well, I'm agnostic. I said, well, so-and-so, how has rejecting God helped you deal with that suffering and pain in your life? How has that made this easier to handle? When we reject God, it doesn't make evil easier to handle. It makes it less identifiable, less hopeful, less defeatable. How will evil even be defeated in the absence of God? It won't, except for when we all die. How has rejecting God helped you there? What about evolution? Evolution, there's many ways to skin this cat, but here's my standard response. Even Richard Dawkins, the famed Darwinist, evolutionist, is baffled at the fine-tuning of our universe and the origin of first life. Neither of these areas can be explained by evolution. These circumvent the argument from evolution. So even the biggest atheist on planet Earth doesn't know what to do with these two subjects. Another way to answer that would be to say some Christians think that God worked entirely through nature without intervening at all. Other Christians think that God specially intervened at every single period to create life. And then other Christians think it's somewhere in the middle. And I'm kind of a moderate. I'm somewhere in the middle. God intervened, let nature do its thing. Good people go to hell. One girl was, this isn't my story, I shouldn't steal it. She was talking to my best friend, who's a terrific evangelist. And she was screaming so loud that the veins were coming out of her neck. She was up sweating, screaming at him. If you think that my grandmother, who is the sweetest woman on God's green earth, is going to burn in hell because she never accepted Christ, then I will go to hell with her rather than be with God in heaven. That's the kind of God you believe in. Well, it's kind of a thorny response. You don't want to criticize her grandmother, right? No, she wasn't. She was sinful like the rest of us. Grandma was evil. Here's the response. This is what he responded with. This has always stuck with me. He said, I think if people knew that they were really good, then they would know that they are not as righteous as God. How could you say I'm really good and yet I'm equally righteous with the creator of the creator God? They need God's forgiveness, not their own self-righteousness. If she was really good, then she would have realized that she needs God's forgiveness. Pretty good response. Okay, another use of apologetics. Prepare for roadblocks. We've all been in these discussions, right? You're talking, things are getting really good, and then you hit an impasse, a roadblock, where the person says, well, that's good for you. I'm just not interested in spiritual things. And you just feel the conversation just grind to a halt. Is the conversation over? It might be. Maybe that's a cue of them saying, I don't want to talk about this anymore, but they're being polite. It could be that that's just a roadblock that you need to circumvent and keep moving. Here's a few ways to get around roadblocks that I found helpful. Again, I don't want this to be formulaic. First I do this, then I do that, then I do the third thing. But these are some ways to circumvent that. First way would be to describe the difference between law and grace. Oh, you're apathetic about spiritual things? You don't think that you have any interest in this? I used to feel exactly the same way until I figured out, or someone told me, that Christianity is not about law, it's about grace. And I thought Christianity was all about the Ten Commandments and being a good person, and that's how you get to heaven. And when someone explained to me that actually this whole thing is about a relationship with God, and He actually gives you forgiveness free, just grace, that really changed my attitude towards things. Now they might say, well, I'm still apathetic. Okay. Well, maybe the next conversation you get in, they say, I'm just not that interested and I don't really care. Well, I wasn't that interested either until somebody instructed me about the uniqueness of Christianity. You know, all the other religions of the world all advocate works in some way. Okay, whether you've got the monotheistic religions that advocate law and good works, or the pantheistic religions, which teach that you have to reach higher and higher levels of enlightenment to get to moksha or nirvana. That is man's effort to reach the final state. But in Christianity, it's actually way different. It's God coming down to us, not us working our way to God. Then thirdly, like I said, I'm not a very good evangelist, but I've got a pretty good personal testimony. And I've got that down where I've got the 2-minute version, the 30-second version, the 2-minute version, and the 10-minute version. And I think every Christian should have that down. Not everyone's going to listen to your story for 10 minutes. I've got good Christian friends who won't listen to me talk for 10 minutes. And the non-Christian friend probably won't listen either, but let's get our testimonies down. Okay, if that won't work, hopefully 90% of the time that's what works. If that doesn't work, we should move into apologetics. If we don't establish what we're arguing for, grace, uniqueness of Christ, how God's changed my life, they might think, when you start arguing for Christianity, they might be thinking, he's trying to argue law. He's trying to argue be a good person. He's trying to argue, I'm not a good person, so I'm going to hell. So we need to explain first what we're arguing for. Then, once we've made our position clear, I think the first thing to lead with is the presuppositional argument. I don't have time to explain what this argument is. I'm going to try to make it really brief. The presuppositional argument is where you explain your Christian worldview and the logical implications of that. Then you put on their worldview hat, be that pantheism, polytheism, atheism, agnosticism, and you explain their worldview from their perspective, and you explain the logical implications of their view. I think the presuppositional approach is the best. First of all, it's seamless. I think that this is one of the best arguments we have, is the presuppositional approach. And it's unexpected. I've talked to the guys down at the Free Thought Movement, the atheistic, we're atheists movement down on campus, and they've heard the cosmological argument. They've heard the teleological, they've heard these are different things. They haven't heard of this, the presuppositional approach. So, I'm going to try and make this really compact, but if you want to read more about this, you can talk to me after class. Morality. You bring up the subject of morality. Let's just do atheism, okay? If you are an atheist, a naturalist, and everything is natural in nature, then how can you look at one area of nature and call it unnatural? It's kind of a mouthful, but think about that. Everything in nature is natural, right? How could it be unnatural in nature? Well, it's natural when a lion kills a gazelle. It's natural when a dolphin forcibly copulates with another dolphin. That's natural. That's not rape. That's just dolphins. Okay. And it's also natural when a race of ants enslaves a race of aphids. Nobody's protesting ant slavery, are they? No. Then why is it unnatural when someone kills an innocent child? When someone tortures a woman? Why isn't that also part of the natural process? Significance. If the universe has no ultimate significance, then how can your life or my life have an ultimate significance? Well, I don't think the universe does have an ultimate significance. Then why do you get up and put your pants on in the morning? Why do you leave your bed? Well, I have to pee. Okay, besides that reason. If the universe itself collectively has no purpose, why does my life have purpose? It's a good discussion question. Free will. If everything in the universe is just cause and effect, then why aren't human decisions the result of cause and effect? Is everything in the universe cause and effect? Yeah, planets don't choose to orbit around the sun. It's physical law. Unsupported objects don't choose to fall to the earth. Physical law. If everything in the universe is just physical law, cause and effect, then why aren't our brains, our minds, our decisions also just cause and effect? Okay. So you start with the presuppositional approach. What you're not supposed to do with the presuppositional argument, which most presuppositionalists do, they pound the non-Christian into the ground, they embarrass them, they've never thought of this, they haven't thought of these issues. Don't humiliate the person, just get them to the point, I don't really know how to describe this, but get them to the point where they just feel like the ground is moving, you know. Whoa, I have never thought about this before. Get them to reconsider their own worldview. Once you do that, you can say, well, I'd like to offer you some more concrete evidence. And here's the order. I am going to be formulaic about this. Here's the order in which I think you should present the evidence. Oh, here's a good question. Would you consider yourself an open-minded person, or do you feel like you've already made up your mind here? If the person's like, I've made up my mind, well, I don't think anything I show you is really going to be helpful. Sorry. Well, nobody wants to be closed-minded. In our postmodern culture, you think anyone's going to say, no, I'm a closed-minded person. I've already made up my mind. They're going to say, okay, I'm open. Okay, this is the order I think that you should go in. Number one, predictive prophecy. Predictive prophecy. I don't know why most apologists don't get into this subject. They think it's just for Jewish evangelism. It's not. We reach more Gentile, God-hating people in our fellowship with predictive prophecy. It's not just for people who believe in the Old Testament. It's for anybody. I think prophecy should be the first thing we lead with, if they're open. First of all, it's the Bible's own apologetic. Isaiah 42 through 48, you just read, God says, you know, I am the Lord, there is no other. Only I can predict the future. Bring me your idols. He's taunting the other gods, the fake gods. Bring me your idols. I'm the only one who can predict the future. Jesus in Luke 24, he holds a Bible study describing how he fulfilled all these Old Testament prophecies. Some people say there's 191 fulfilled prophecies. That's true. They are. That's the Josh McDowell approach. He says that there's 61 prophecies fulfilled in Christ. One of the fulfillments McDowell gives is that Jesus is sitting at the right hand of God. Psalm 110. Another prophecy is fulfilled as the virgin birth. See, Isaiah 7:14 predicts the virgin birth. Matthew 1:23, there it is, fulfilled. Okay, it was fulfilled. Jesus was born of a virgin. Is anyone going to find that very compelling? No, they're not going to find that compelling. I like to limit it to the prophecy of Daniel 9, Isaiah 53, and Psalm 22. There are others. Zechariah 12, Micah 5, too. There's other prophecies that are also good, but I think those three are the strongest. Just focus on those three. Don't make the claim there's 191 prophecies. Wow. And then 90% of them, we can't back up evidentially, even if they were fulfilled. Secondly, Big Bang cosmology and fine-tuning. I like the cosmological argument because we can show it scientifically. Big Bang cosmology is something people read in their high school textbook, something they learn in college. It's the consensus of modern physics today. It's not Christian Science. Big Bang cosmology, you can make an argument for the first cause of the universe, and fine-tuning. And then finally, I think historical apologetics are pretty good. Now, most apologists will reverse this order. Or maybe they'll bring this up and bring this one to the very bottom. When J.P. Moreland was here, we were asking him, why don't you and William Lane Craig and these other guys use predictive prophecy in your debates and that sort of thing? And he was kind of like, it's good evidence. It's just whenever Paul does it in the book of Acts, he's always doing it to Jews or to God-fearers. So we don't feel like we should do that in a secular society. But whenever we would make counter-arguments, he would say, no, that's a good point. Maybe we should use it more. But I kind of got the feeling that he was just flattering us. But now, Moreland knows more about apologetics. Moreland forgot more about apologetics than I'll ever know. Okay, but I still think the approach is that I think predictive prophecy should be led first thing. Goals for your conversation. One goal is have them offer their explanation. Never be the only one who's giving your explanation for how things are. One example is the problem of evil. Well, I have an explanation for the problem of evil. Before I give you my explanation, I'd like to hear what your explanation is. How do you deal with the problem of evil? Oh, should I say schooled a kid? I schooled him. He was a high school student, but he came forward and he said, 2 Kings 3, man, Elisha, out in the wilderness. 42 young boys come out and say, get up, Baldy, go up, Baldy, and they're yelling at him, calling him Bald. And Elisha prays to the God of heaven, and God brings a bunch of bears, and they come and eat these 42 boys. How could you believe in a God like that? So I was like, well, I've got an explanation for that. What's your explanation? He said, what do you mean? I said, do you think that's wrong that 40, or all those bears ate 42 young boys? He said, well, yeah, it's wrong because, you know, because you believe in a God who answered that prayer. I'm like, wait. Do you think it's wrong on your worldview that bears ate boys? I don't think it's wrong on your worldview. You're a naturalist, and those bears got a really good lunch that day. Really tender young boy meat they got to eat. I think it was a nice thing, actually. He said, well, from your worldview, though, you know, you're a Christian, you believe that God's loving. How could you do that? Ah, so you have to prop up the Christian God in order and use the Christian morality in order to say that was wrong, even though you don't believe that from your worldview? I thought it was pretty good. Anyways, number two, press an irrational conclusion. The one guy I was talking to is an atheist. We were talking about Big Bang cosmology and the first cause of the universe. I said, the consensus of modern physics believes that the universe began ex nihilo, out of nothing. All energy, matter, everything sprung into being. He said, yeah, I don't agree with that. I think the universe has always existed. I said, did you realize what you just said? You're saying that you're disagreeing with modern science in your view? He said, yeah, well, not all scientists agree with that. I said, well, yeah, not all of them, but the consensus, Stephen Hawking, John Barrow, I listed a number of scientists who hold Big Bang cosmology, and he said, well, yeah, I just don't agree. I said, you don't agree with professors in universities who believe this? You don't agree with the modern? I said, well, as a Christian, I'd rather have the view that's supported by science rather than being an atheist and have the view that's not supported by science. So you can press an irrational conclusion. That's fine. I think that's okay if that person has to deal with that in their worldview. Is morality objective? No, it's not. You don't think it's objective. It's not wrong to torture a little baby for fun. No, that's not wrong. Well, good luck. Good luck getting married. Good luck in life. You can't even agree that that's wrong. Follow the one and done rule. If you win one argument, don't go for two. Please be quiet. Don't go for two. If the non-Christian person is humble enough to give you a point and say, you know, that's a good point, don't be like, and then predictive prophecy, and then, you know, Tacitus said, and then just be quiet and say, well, okay, what have you been watching on TV lately? Switch the subject. Talk about something else. finally, explain the nature of faith. Explain that faith is something that all of us do all the time. For example, when you hop on an airplane, you ever think about what you're doing when you're on an airplane? You're flying in a giant metal casket, 500 miles an hour, 30,000 feet in the air. Okay, you don't know if they filled up the gas tank. You don't know if the pilot was drinking at the bar before he got in the cockpit. You don't know that, but what did you do? You paid your money and you trusted. You got on the plane. You didn't see it, but you trusted in good authority that this is true. One guy I was talking to at a restaurant, we were sitting there talking, and he said, "I just can't believe I have a hard time with faith." I said, "You're exercising faith right now." He's about to bite into a big, giant cheeseburger, a really juicy cheeseburger. I said, "You didn't watch the cook make that meal. You didn't watch him sit on the toilet for 10 minutes, not wash his hands afterwards. How do you know he didn't spray poison on top of that cheeseburger?" "Well, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely absurd." It is absurd, but you see, it's an exercise of faith. You're believing something even though you can't see it. Based on what? Based on evidence. Based on good authority. Finally, you can explain the stakes. This came up in a conversation with a buddy of mine last night. What if someone's just really apathetic? Well, explain the stakes. Imagine if your girlfriend was taken by a rapist and taken off into the fields of Michigan, which is where all rapists live, by the way. Go Bucks. She's taken into the fields of Michigan. She's with some cruel, sadistic rapist out there. And the cops come up to you and you say, "You know, what's the damage? How, are we going to be able to find her or not?" And the cop says, "Well, there's a 1% chance that you could actually find your girlfriend. We're searching, but he could be in a bunker. He could be, we can't find him. There's only 1% chance we'll ever find your girlfriend ever again." What would you tell the cop? 1%? Boy, those odds are really low. You know what? Just tell the boys down at the station. Just eat some donuts and chill out. I'm sure there's something good on TV. You know, I don't want the whole police force going after her with 1% odds. That'd be really silly. I'm sure you guys have better things to do. Well, if you didn't value the object of your search, then you wouldn't move in that search, would you? But if the object of your search is important, you should search for it. You would search for it. One line my friend uses is he'll be talking to someone and they'll be explaining things and the person will say, "Well, I just need to think about that some more." He always leans in and he says, "Well, that's fine, but in the meantime, drive carefully." It's kind of a tongue-in-cheek way of saying, that's cool, but you don't have forever. Anything could happen. Anything could happen in between now and then. Well, that's all I had. I left us 10 minutes to do some Q&A. I finished earlier than I did last year. Any questions before we pray? Yeah.
Is the 10-week class you're teaching online?
Very good question. Yeah. Can I steal this, Joe?
Sure. Those of us who live in Cincinnati.
Sure.
And is this part of the old CP class?
No.
No?
All right. Shh. Very important announcement. Shh. The class I'm doing, I'm starting a website. This is the web address up here, and I'm going to put all the MP3s on there for free. So it's not going to be up until September. I'm going to do all the editing, and we're going to launch the website at the end of the summer.
So this isn't part of the old CD class?
No.
This is something.
Yeah, something different. Okay, right up here.
In addition to that great resource, do you have any other recommendations on like a primer that would give a good overview of like common objections and
hey, shh, chill out. What's that?
So a
primer for apologetics?
Yeah.
Okay, the question is there a good like introductory resource for apologetics? There's a few good books if you want to take these down. On Guard by William Lane Craig is a layperson version of his more difficult work, Reasonable Faith. On Guard by William Lane Craig. Then there's I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. It's a really catchy title. By Norman Geisler and Frank Turek. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And then, you know, Lee Strobel is still good. Just everything he does is good. So just keep going with Strobel. It's good stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, so if we're like talking.
before we talk with them, should we be like thinking about like almost like every response they may be giving us, whatever? Like, cause sometimes I feel like I'll be in the conversation, they'll be kind of taking it in a direction that I don't really want to go, because I'm not very confident in that direction.
Yeah.
So should we be trying to like guide it along, or like how should we, you know what I'm saying, like deal with that?
I see what you're saying. Well, I guess my response would be twofold. First, we should be guiding and leading the discussion where it's headed. We don't, in other words, you don't want rabbit trails. Well, what about this? Well, what about that? Well, what? Well, I'll answer that if we can focus on this other thing. So you don't want to be rabbit trailing all over the place. On the other hand, if a person, non-Christian, asks you something you don't know the answer to, what you should not do is make something up. Like our new believer did in our home church. What about the Council of Nicaea? That's when they made the Bible, 325. Well, that council never existed, you know. He just kind of made that up. So what you should just do is just be honest and say, Council of what? N-I-C-E-A, Nicaea. I'm going to look that up, and I don't know the answer to that, but I'm going to find that out. I know there's answers out there for that. And what you're doing is you're modeling being humble, and hopefully they'll throw you some tokens in return. Say, I don't know how to respond to that either. Think about it. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, what do you do if you're offering predictive prophecy and the person that you're talking to doesn't even believe in Scripture? That's where I think many of the prophecies you can't show evidentially, like the virgin birth. I believe the virgin birth happened, of course. I believe it was fulfilled, as Matthew 1:23 says. But you can't prove that evidentially from outside the Bible. So we don't want to get into a thing where we're saying the Bible fulfills the Bible. That'd be the same thing as saying, why is the Bible the Word of God? Because it says so. That's circular reasoning. It's begging the question. But I think the right response is to pick the prophecies which can be shown evidentially from outside of the Bible. So Daniel 9:24-27 says that the Messiah will be cut off in AD 33. Now, Jesus of Nazareth was crucified under Pontius Pilatus, which is in Tacitus, in his annals, the chapter 15, verse 44. Tacitus, a second century historian, says Jesus was killed under Pilate, under Emperor Tiberius. Now, Pilate reigned from 26 to 36, and Emperor Tiberius was in the same neck of the woods. So while we can't prove that it was the same year, we can show that it was in the same decade, the same time. Then you've got Isaiah 53, which describes the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ, which I think those can be attested extra-biblically as well. We can make historical arguments for that. And Psalm 22, verse 16, which says, they will pierce my hands and feet. He received the maximum penalty, that's the way Tacitus says. But Lucian says that he was crucified. They worshiped their crucified sage. So this was being predicted 1,000 years in advance, and we can show that that was actually fulfilled extra-biblically, not biblically. Then if they agree with historical apologetics, we can do that. Yeah?
What would be the most concise way to explain
Christianity? The most concise way would be, I usually say, have you heard what's been going on in physics in the last decade? Physicists have been discovering somewhere between 30 and 50 physical laws, constants, and initial conditions that if they weren't finely tuned and exact, current life would not exist. And by current life, we mean no possible life. So probably the easiest way. But you can always give them some reading, yeah.
You talked about like asking if they're open-minded before you go into this conversation. What, I guess, just like from your opinion, what would you do if like someone said they're open-minded, then you make a point and they almost get angry about it because it shatters their beliefs?
Well, I think that question is just trying to get them geared toward the idea of, am I really trying to search, or have I already made up my mind? And if someone's not being consistent, you can say, well, you know, you would use this rationale in other areas of life and have no problem with it. But for some reason, when we apply this rationale to God, it seems like you're not willing to do that. So I'm seeing some inconsistency there. You'd be willing to exercise faith over here, but not over there, something like that. Okay, last one.
Okay. I'm just curious with the is my grandma going to hell thing.
Yeah.
Was that response, what happened? What was the effect?
In hospitality, they tell you, I was in hospitality for a while, they tell you that as the customer is getting louder and louder, you're supposed to get quieter and quieter. Where are my bags? Where are these things? Sir, I would just like to tell you that we're going to have your bags up to your room in just a moment. And to the point where the person feels so stupid for yelling. So he delivered it in that way. She was screaming, and he came back and was like, if your grandma was really good, then she would know that she needs forgiven just like the rest of us. So it's basically a whisper. Okay. And it was pretty effective.
Yeah. I've run into that a lot for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I just don't know what to do in this situation.
So I think it's not only what you're saying, but it's also the demeanor in which you're saying it. So okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jim.
See you guys later.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.